tonight, which something which to my mind is probably one of the most difficult chapters in all of the literature on mysticism. Mostly because it isn't something tangible. And also because you have to work with it with a faculty which has no reality. And as a result, we find ourselves reaching out or in or up or down, and nowhere can we get a finger lock on the thing we're seeking. And that's precisely what finally forces us to let go and to stop striving to understand it, to touch it, to embrace it, to encompass it. And eventually, it forces us to stop being that which we have thought we ourselves are. This is a self-demolition program. And the harder you strive to find something, the more you realize the only way you can find is for you to disappear. Consciousness is a word that probably never entered our vocabulary, let's say 20 years ago, or 10, or even 5. The word consciousness was only something we thought of in a human sense. I'm conscious or I'm unconscious. It never occurred to us to equate the word consciousness with God. That if I can be conscious, certainly God is conscious. And if God is conscious, it must be a different kind of consciousness than my human idea of consciousness. That never occurred to us. And when we peek into this little chapter, which creeps into our lives very unobtrusively, if you happen to be open at the time, it's just apt to lay you right down in the aisles. It can take you and upend you and completely change your life if something in you is ready for just that chapter. The thing it can really do is make consciousness almost tangible, so that you discover a new country called consciousness, and you wander in it as a stranger. And you find it's the only reality there ever was. It's a sort of a complete sense of wonderment out in consciousness. Now you take a 6-year-old child and you put it to bed and you have it say its little prayer. And I pray the Lord my soul to keep. Without realizing it, we are shaping that child's future a certain way. It now has a concept of God up there, and me, the little boy down here, and this great feeling that God is watching over me. A feeling that someday, either in his adolescence, when a bigger boy just plunks him right on his jaw, or a little later, when he gets married and finds out it isn't a bed of roses, or a little later still, when there's an accident of some kind in the family, and finally when his business isn't quite what he thought it was, and he goes bankrupt. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. May have, in some way, contributed to all of these sequences in his life. He had depended upon an unknown God. He had depended upon a God that he didn't know had no existence. And as he filled his years, he fumbled and sought that God. Having been separated almost from birth, in fact before birth, his entire life was lived either seeking God or renouncing the possibility of the God he couldn't find. And he becomes a member of the human race. who has sought God from the beginning, who has not found God, and divides itself up into atheists and theists and agnostics, all of whom are in the same boat, all of whom either have found a false God or are seeking a false God or deny that there is a God because someone told them to lay themselves down and bless the Lord and hope that the Lord would keep their souls. They weren't taught what we so belatedly are being taught by Job, that God and consciousness are one and the same, and that behind the visible is the invisible consciousness which makes possible the ultimate appearance of form. All of us have thought of ourselves as form. Along comes Joel and we decide or learn that we're not form at all. We're life. And we discover that life and consciousness and soul are one and the same. Life, consciousness, God consciousness. Now if you've read the chapter, you may have been impressed to the point of saying, how could one mind know all this? How could one man be so privy to the secrets of life that all of these chapters through him could flow? It's truly astounding. And yet we know now that these chapters could flow through him because he wasn't thinking them up. He was letting consciousness do its own work. And he was being an instrument for that consciousness because he knew that his name was consciousness and that the form was not him. We may feel that to a degree, but we still have to learn how to live that way. And then he gives us examples which, though simple, are truly deep. I recall a book I read which told about birds. And I thought I had finally found why birds migrated at certain times of the year, and this author had a secret. They had a sense of knowing where their food was, and at certain times of the year, their food disappeared where they were, and they had a sense of knowing their food was somewhere else. They instantly, like a homing pigeon, went directly to that food, even if it happened to be in Capistrano. And that sounded very plausible. It was a great secret. Only it wasn't true. And then we have thought about this homing instinct of the bird, this migrating instinct, little realizing that behind it was God. It was God consciousness that was doing the migrating, and the bird was simply an out of form appearing as evidence of the invisible consciousness of God. We have always said, look at the seed. Isn't it amazing that an oak tree can come out of that seed? And then we would teach a child, see the seed? See that oak tree? That oak tree came from this acorn. And then the scientist tells us, if you look in that acorn, you can see all of that oak tree. It's like a microfilm. It contains the fullness of that oak tree right here in that little acorn. And you know, that's not true. That's not true at all. But science, seeking to, in some way, find plausible reasons to account for these things, has overlooked what we have overlooked, the invisible consciousness which pours through that acorn and becomes the oak. The oak isn't in the acorn. The oak is in the consciousness that makes the appearance of an acorn. And we find behind all of these visibles is the invisible vitality of an invisible consciousness. Now, we're not half as smart, it would appear, as the little squirrel. And there are these little animals who, for some unknown reason, store up in excess at certain times of the year and less at other times. The other examples Job gives is the deer and the bear, who for some reason have less fat in their system at certain times and more at other times. You can almost predict the weather on the basis of it. And of the fur-bearing animals, who aren't consciously, volitionally, doing anything to their fur whatsoever. They're not conscious of the fact that it's going to be hot or cold a month or two from now, or that it's going to be a blizzard. And yet there is an invisible consciousness that functions, and that outwardly they work hitherto, just as Jesus did. And we have talked about protective coloration. How nature will adjust so that the bird is protectively colored to appear as the color of the bark of the tree. But when we said nature, we were using a word sort of vaguely. What we didn't know was that the consciousness of the universe is the protective coloration that we see. And so on, down the human vegetation. We have thought how marvelous that a man in the deep tropical climate can adjust with a dark skin, little realizing that that man wasn't adjusting. We have thought his body could adjust, but his body wasn't adjusting. Consciousness anticipating the need. Consciousness going before to make the crooked places straight would make the darker conscious for the darker pigmentation and the deeper pigmentation for the lighter colored and the more shallow pigmentation, depending on the need. And had we known this, there would have been a good deal less of the personal animosities that we are experiencing today. All because I lay me down to sleep and pray the Lord my soul to keep was our standard prayer for the infants. We could not see that a child is already started on the way, separate from God, separate from consciousness, and that it now learns certain things from its elders, from all of its prenatal influences, from all of this preconditioning before it even enters this visible world. And then it's taught about God, who is looking down over this earth. And I'm reminded of Joel's little anecdote in which he talks about a father and son, and the child was on the stoop 3 or 4 steps high, and the father would say jump, and the child would jump, and the father would catch the child. And the child would run up gleefully and wait, and the father would say, jump. The child would jump, and the father would catch the child. But one time, the father missed. When the child jumped, and the child would never jump again. And this would be a scar, of course, so that the child would learn, if you can't trust your own father, you can't trust anyone. And this is how we became about God. We jumped, and there was no God to catch us. And we lost the understanding that the place whereon I stand is holy ground. And now we had a God who wasn't anywhere where I was. We were separated now from consciousness because we didn't know there was such a thing. We saw the moon and the stars, and learned about planets, and saw the orbits of the heavenly bodies. But we never learned what was doing it. The astronomer never told us. The astronomer figured there was something in these heavenly bodies that did it. He wasn't quite aware of an unseen intelligence. He had all kinds of names. Gravity. Never thinking that behind all this is an infinite intelligence which we are looking at And we are seeing not forms that the infinite intelligence put there, but forms that we are subconsciously devising as we look at that which we cannot see. Now this intelligence then, this composite of all that eventually flows into human experience in diluted forms is God. Alive, vibrant, real, ever-present, infinite, perfect, flawless. So homogenized that everywhere you go, the full infinite qualities of God are present at every point. God in China, consciousness in China, is identical to consciousness in Kansas City. Consciousness beneath the surface of the ocean is identical to consciousness on the land and 20,000 leagues above the sea. There is no place where God is less or more than in any place. So that if a mind collapsed on you, God is in that collapsed mind just as upstairs in the world that is praying for your safety. Now become aware of this homogenized infinite consciousness. It's simply returning to our original state called the Eden consciousness. And this reborning to self is the return of the prodigal, who through various conditionings, various influences, various superstitions, various states of ignorance, became not consciousness, but an evolving series of states of consciousness. So everywhere we look today, invisibly is consciousness, and also invisibly is an evolving state of consciousness, and then visibly is the form that that evolving state of consciousness takes with its experience. Between the form and the invisible infinite consciousness is the finite consciousness, which is the human mind, interpreting that which it cannot understand and being subject to the laws of chance. Now you standing here today, and I, are all of one consciousness. Invisibly we are the same substance. We are indivisible from that substance, for I can never leave thee. If you make your bed in hell, I consciousness will be there. And we learn then that this I, which is spoken of by Jesus, and also called the Father within, which doeth the works, is the infinite consciousness, which is the substratum of this entire universe. That infinite consciousness is ever present. And there is no power on the face of the earth that ever can prevent it from functioning in its perfection. It is the question of why isn't consciousness doing this or that? It's the question of how meek can I be to receive that which is being itself. Always consciousness is being itself. Always consciousness is functioning perfectly in the invisible. And because we have entertained a false sense of ourselves, a material sense, we do not benefit by the activity of consciousness until we bring ourselves to a point where we first recognize that consciousness alone is reality, and that which appears here as me, as form, is not my identity whatsoever. I must, to return to the Father's house, identify myself as the only life there is, which is the consciousness. If I am not consciousness, I am a disembodied nothing, unconnected, without substance, without life, moving through a void, a mental image, calling yourself a man or a woman. And so my return to the Father's house, my rebirth, begins somewhere with the realization that the same consciousness which fills the barns for a squirrel, which fills full baskets full for the multitudes, which reveals the non-existence of evil, which moves through the sky, through the ocean, that consciousness is ever maintaining a perfect sun. And even though I appear not to be that one, I must accept my identity as that perfect self. And know that now, this mental projection of me which is imperfect must slowly be absorbed into the one which is the perfect self. Of my own self, I cannot do this, but I can remove the personal sense of self. I can remove the personal sense of responsibility and recognize that the government is on the shoulders of the consciousness which is ever present. Certainly, if it can put a fur overcoat on us, on an animal, in anticipation of wintry weather, it can do whatever is necessary for the wintry weather that I will experience. If it could put a lighter pigmentation on me and a darker one on another, without any volitional effort on our part, why can't it run my business? Why can't it run my marriage? Why can't it run my parental relationship with my children? Why can't it run its life, which I am? And so I become aware that the consciousness has a will. A will that is perfect, and a power to fulfill that will. And a presence and a mind to receive that will and to enforce that power so that he that is within me, my consciousness, is greater than every form on the face of the earth. And wherever I happen to be in the form, my consciousness is, it can never leave me or forsake me. And so I begin to draw on that consciousness which has shown its power in anticipating the needs of the bird, the bee, the squirrel, the seed, the plant, in functioning the organs of the human body, in determining the speed of a heartbeat, the number of times that a lung should exhale and inhale. None of us have done this volitionally. And yet we have departed from consciousness, from the Father's house. The entire story then of the prodigal is similar to the fall from the Garden of Eden. That inability to recognize invisible consciousness is present everywhere that a visible form appears. Before there were seeds in the ground, there was consciousness. Before there was cattle on a thousand hills, there was consciousness. Before there was a light in the sky called the sun, there was consciousness. Before there was you or I, there was consciousness. And every error that appears in our physical lives can be discovered in the degree to which we have departed mentally from that invisible consciousness, leaving a sense of separation and permitting new powers to enter our world to cause fear, doubt, anxiety, lack, limitation, evil, disease, birth and death, all because we have been unaware of the invisible and only thinking we had solved the mystery of life because we have managed to penetrate the visible perhaps a little more, because we have become aware of invisible microbes still in the realm of matter, and always placing our faith on human man-made instruments, human man-made understanding, human man-made ideas about the universe, and never realizing that the human mind is incapable of receiving the truth of God. Now we have a completely different awareness of God then. We know that God is the only thing that I can be. If I'm other than God, I'm a polygon. We know that the word God itself has been responsible for our inability to know the meaning of that word. But when we see that God is consciousness, oh yes, I am consciousness too. What else could I be? If consciousness is the fabric of all that is. Now we have been living a life of form. But what good is form if it has no fabric? Without fabric, a form is a shadow. So we have had a modicum of fabric and a maximum of form. And because we've had all form without fabric, we've had error. We couldn't stretch out the substance to support the form. We didn't have enough substance. We had separated ourselves from substance by personal effort. The belief that my will, my desire, my ambition, my life, my mind are all fully capable of attaining an understanding of the mystery of life. Now, all we've succeeded in doing is making ourselves humanly a bit more comfortable, more successful, more secure, but only temporarily. We hadn't discovered that consciousness doesn't die. Consciousness doesn't go into a coffin. Consciousness doesn't have disease. Consciousness multiplies constantly. It never divides. Had we known more of this fabric, we would not have sought the things. And now, learning of the fabric, we do not seek the things. We do not seek things, we do not ask for things, we do not knock for things. Because all we're going to get out of things is form again. Form, not made of the fabric of consciousness, but form made of the fabric of the human mind. And the very thing we reach out for and grasp, and elatedly pull to ourselves and claim ownership, is but an image and thought, without the real, permanent fabric of God itself. Now every era that we experience then is an absence of that fabric, which is consciousness, God, soul, self. And there is no error that cannot be removed by contact with the fabric, because the fabric is unlike any other we have known. It is self-enforcing. It has a mind, an omniscience, and omnipotence, and it has the power then to fulfill itself in perpetuity So that once we have found ourselves to be this consciousness, we can see that all form must outgrow itself. We're not concerned about holding on to a momentary form in the slightest bit. In fact, we can see that our own self consciousness produces invisible, changing form. We know that right now that which we call our body is changing. The very cells themselves are changing. The infant body became an adolescent body. The adolescent became more mature. And as the body keeps changing, we know this is the unfoldment of consciousness. We become unconcerned about maintaining that form at any age level. We don't want the stagnation of form. We want the experience of fabric fulfilling itself, because we have learned that consciousness, when it is received through the unconditioned mind, will ever form itself into the perfect form necessary for the perfect experience. And we do not try to strive to stand there telling consciousness we want this kind of form or that, because that consciousness which produces the lily, the tree, the forest, the flower, the heavenly bodies, that consciousness will always produce the perfect form for the perfect experience. We do not set ourselves up as a human law. We do not try to cling. Instead, we release that consciousness into our experience, and we find that the body showing forth the fabric of consciousness shows forth the perfection of that fabric in all its ways.
The heart which had slowed down, or the pulse which had speeded up, the various glands which had refused to function in the divine image, suddenly we find there's a law which prevents them from doing anything but functioning in the divine image. And now we are connected to that law. Now this consciousness then is present every moment, every hour, every day, unto eternity. And this consciousness is functioning now as your perfect self. Your degree of separation from this consciousness is the degree to which you invite the experiences of mortality.
As you are able to release your mind, your beliefs, your thoughts, your desires, you can find a certain place. And we're going to find that right now, because there is a way to find that place so that consciousness and you are revealed as one and the same. Now at the moment your mind may be wandering a bit, but you can use that mind to steady yourself. You might try it this way, to be still in the mind now, to feel the total flow of infinite consciousness expressing itself as the universe and where you are. Let your mind know that there is no good in this world and there is no evil. There is only my spirit. And stop right there. Hold right there and do not budge. Don't go anywhere. Don't strive to find anything. Just stop right there. And be still in the knowledge there is no good. There is no evil. There is only my spirit. And as you hold there, you'll find a rest. It's as if you had a triangle in which three sides of that triangle are no larger than 1 inch. And you're inside those three sides and you stay there. You're not in thought. You're not in feeling. You're being stirred. And infinity flows into that little triangle and up through it and out and forms the tree of life where you stand. The longer you hold that moment of rest, the closer you are to finding that consciousness is living you. And it will dissolve the false mental projection that you have devised of yourself. It will straighten that which is crooked. It will put food on the table. It will move into your office now before you get there tomorrow. That consciousness will keep the fire from your doorstep. That consciousness is ever performing its function. And when that consciousness comes through the moment of rest, then the infinite perfection of the universe is living your life. And it is your function to let this infinite perfection live your life eternally. It is your function to lay aside that human desire to determine your own direction and to trust this invisible consciousness now and wherever you are. When it lives your life without you taking thought, then grace is functioning as your being. And then it will store that which is necessary in your bonds. It will multiply that which you require until your need is met. It will become your vision. It will become the power of your hands. It will become your brain. It will become all that you are, filling your cup of life to the level of your need at all times. This living consciousness is God. This living consciousness is you. I and the Father are one and the same. And if there's a shadow between this consciousness and you, that shadow is going to be a lack or a limitation or a disease or a problem of some kind. Now, too often, when we hear about going within, we make the mistake of going within. We think you have to go somewhere to go within. And going within doesn't mean going at all. It means standing still. And behold, the salvation of consciousness, the Father within. Now watch how easy it is to create duality when you have a problem. The first thing you want to do is to remove the problem, and you're in duality instantly. You're in duality because you have a problem, and then you want to erase the problem, and that deepens your duality. And then you hear about going within, and so you strive to go within. But you can't go within. Consciousness is omnipresent. Going within is realizing that you're already in consciousness. You already are consciousness. And the going within is knowing it. That's all, knowing it. You're in consciousness now. Now where will you go to go within? To go within means to come out of thought. When you come out of thought, you are within. When you find the moment of rest from thought, you are in consciousness without a suppositional opposite. You are in one power. You are in one mind. You are in one law. You are in one universe instead of two worlds. And the law of that universe is perfection now and forever. There's nothing you need to do about it. Simply be there. And then we find that I am my own self. If I try to do something, I am pushing away that which I seek. Already, that which you seek, you are. You are everything that consciousness is. And consciousness is God. The only separation from it comes in the belief that I am not that. You see how suddenly this refines itself so that you are able to stand on the point of a needle. And the more you practice standing on that point of the needle, the more you will remove the shadow of duality, of a thinking human mind, of a quivering heart remembering past failures. In the total silence of your human selfhood, that's what silence is, the total silence of a human selfhood, and then what's left? Consciousness, reality. Now the rebirth, the return to the Father's house, is the knowing that I have no return to make. I never stop being consciousness because nothing else exists. I never stop being the perfect self, for there is no other self. I never stop living in the kingdom of God because there is no other place. And so we stop seeking God. We do not search for God. He who is searching for God is a dual self. There is no one to search for God. There is no one to seek God. There is only I, the Father. And I, the Father, individualized as you, the Son. My individual selfhood is God, the Father. The moment I seek, I am denying myself. The moment I try to find God, I am denying that I am. And that departure from the I am that I am is duality. Now, because we have not been taught this from infancy, we do not draw upon the consciousness which is life itself. Only that consciousness which is life can feed us life and maintain us in life and manifest us as life. But we draw not upon this divine consciousness. We draw upon a human consciousness. In other words, we do not serve consciousness. We do not serve God. We serve the mammon consciousness. And as a result of it, in this separation, we experience the absence of the substance of life. And this is what we call death. But what is diet? A form, a mental image. Now let's face it then, the only death there will ever be is the death of a mental image. And the only birth there will ever be is the birth of a mental image. Consciousness is the only substance. It isn't born and it doesn't die. Consciousness is covering all that we call time and space. Consciousness is immortal and eternal. And the only thing any of us can be is consciousness. Which means the only thing we can be is immortal and eternal. Consciousness is all intelligence, and therefore the only thing we can be is all intelligence. Now you begin to feel that there must be a self-effacement. The longer we cling to my mind, my body, myself, my ideas, the longer we are a prodigal who has not returned to self, to the Father's house, to that power which never makes mistakes, and that power which is always love, which is always harmony, which is always beauty, which is always justice, which is always truth, which is always functioning. Now you may be surprised to discover, if you have not up to this moment, that after this chapter becomes more a part of you, even after you have laid it down for a night, you may awaken, go into a meditation, and discover to your great astonishment and joy that you are in the divine consciousness. And then just as the moon ceases to be a light in the morning when the sun comes out, you will find your mind and your body, your entire human selfhood is obliterated in this experience of consciousness realized. And you're not the slightest bit unhappy about it. As a matter of fact, you find you can't speak. You have touched the living, full, ever-present consciousness that is God, and you're aware of it. You're in it, you are it. You know that you're walking on streets of gold that are invisible. The experience can never leave you. No matter where you are or when, you will remember that experience. And you will know that until I get back to that experience on a permanent basis, I'm in duality. Because right around me now is harmony, perfection, truth, beauty. And put them all together, plus the infinite other qualities of consciousness, and you have a perpetual paradise which is invisible to all human sense, but ever present, and it is the substance of your own being. It is finished. It is a kingdom already established. It doesn't have to be built. It has to be accepted by self-surrender. The personal self, meek unto this consciousness, the human mind, daily imbued with truth from within, all this dissolves into that which is the pure in heart, showing forth the activity of God. Now, if you could take a little case such as this one as an example, take a woman who, for some strange reason, has a streak of fear in her, and it wells up from time to time without any warning and without any apparent purpose. Just like the wind suddenly blowing from the north. And this streak of wind or fear will run through her. At the most awkward times, and almost make her weep because she doesn't know what to do or where it's come from. And yet, there have been times in this person's life when she has received a voice. Such as once when the voice spoke and said, "I am you." Now you have received a voice. And the rather peculiar part is this, that when we receive the voice for the experience of consciousness, we seem to think that that applies only to that moment when it happened. But when the voice says to you, "I am you," that means eternally. And when you're not receiving the voice, that's true too, and it's true 50 years later. Whenever you receive a God experience, that which you are receiving is a permanent dispensation. It doesn't matter if that experience departs from you, it's still the permanent truth and ever present. And the point is, you can depend on it. Now, I say that for this purpose. You may have a momentary problem that, in some way, seems to be causing alarm. And you may be striving to find that inner touch of the Spirit to remove it. And yet we're doing all this work over and over and over again without realizing that the same Spirit that spoke to me a month ago gave me the answer then. Why am I striving so hard? This consciousness, this Spirit, is ever present. I have been striving to get it to come into my experience, and that's a mistake. I needn't strive to get it to come into my experience. It is my reality now. I must not strive to bring Spirit into my human experience. Instead, I must remove the human sense of self, because the Spirit is here. I must remove the human sense of self, and Spirit will show forth as the removal of my problem. Now, the only effort you make is to find no effort. This is so delicate that if you have the least bit of effort, you're in duality. But when you are capable of no effort, in the knowledge that I already am, all I need to do is remove that which I am not. I am not flesh and blood. I am not matter. I am not human mind formed. I am Spirit. And I don't have to think about it. I am Spirit. And then I rest in the vacuum of that mind. Now, another chapter you should read in conjunction with this one, and Joel made that notation in the chapter, is in the Thunder of Silence. Who told you? And Of course, the moment you read it, you'll know exactly why it must be read in conjunction with this. God is infinite consciousness and God is individual consciousness. Because he gives you a perfect way to find the point of rest. And I have just given it to you a moment ago. When the mind creates his little triangle, he didn't say it this way, incidentally, but I am, so that you can remember that little triangle inside the mind, just an inch in every direction, and get your mind inside it and stay there in the vacuum.